Hello, and welcome to the Open Systems Media eCast series, Rise of the Robot Overlords, Clarifying the Industrial IoT. I'm Kurt Schwader, your moderator. This series is presented by Stan Schneider, CEO of Real-Time Innovations. With over 1,000 designs, RTI is the largest IoT connectivity framework vendor. RTI software runs the largest power plants in North America, connects perception to control in vehicles, coordinates combat management in U.S. Navy ships, drives a new generation of medical robotics and controls Hyperloop and flying cars, and provides 24/7 medical intelligence to hospital patients and emergency victims. Stan serves on the Industrial IoT Consortium Steering Committee. The IIC is the largest industrial IoT consortia with over 250 members. He also serves on the advisory board for the industry's largest event, the IoT Solutions World Congress. He received the Embedded Computing Design's Top Embedded Innovator Award in 2015 and was ranked number 8 in IoT1's Top 100 IIoT Influencers in 2017. He completed his Ph.D. in EE in Computer Science at Stanford with a thesis on autonomous systems at the Stanford Aerospace Robotics Laboratory. Before we get started today, I want to talk a little bit about the housekeeping. Today's format is a presentation followed by audience Q&A. Your viewing console consists of a set of windows. You can open, close, move, or resize at your preference. On entry, you'll see a picture of our presenter, a biography, and the presentation slides in the slides window, and a Q&A window that enables you to participate today. There are 7 icons across the bottom of your screen. Clicking those on the far left will reset your viewing area. The rest of the icons will open or close their corresponding windows. You can hover over your mouse over each window, and it'll show what it controls. There's also a handout icon, third from the right, I want to point out. It opens the handout window with the presenter's slide, so you can follow along with or download that for future reference. As I mentioned, the Q&A reference window allows you to participate today. You can simply type your question into the Ask a Question text box, then hit Submit. We encourage you to ask a lot of questions during the event. Take advantage of the expertise we have here today. We'll address as many of these as we can during the closing Q&A, and if you have a question pertaining to the eCast operation itself, you can submit those too, and one of our technicians will be happy to help you. This and all Open Systems Media eCasts are copyrighted and may not be recorded or used in any way without the express written consent of Open Systems Media. So with that, let's get started. Stan, the floor is yours.
Thank you. I need to get a shorter bio. I wonder if I have time left now. Anyhow, this is the first of a hopeful series of presentations on titling The Rise of the Robot Overlords. I'll explain why in a second here. But, you know, really what it's trying to do is understand and help clarify what the industrial IoT is. And, you know, the first part here is the introduction, which is really more, you know, what is the industrial IoT anyway, and why am I calling it the Rise of the Overlords? So we'll move on. I'm going to start out with a story. A while back, my 14-year-old came home with a not-so-great report card. And, you know, as most parents, you're a little bit dismayed by that. And I showed it to him, and I'm talking about it. And I asked him, what do you want to be when you grow up? And he looked up at me, and he actually looked down at our dog sleeping on the floor. And he looked back at me and said, Dad, I want to be a pet of the robot overlords. And I was like, what? turns out, you know, there's some, his brother had been talking about robot overlords or something, but I was like pretty upset about that. Like, you know, how is that my legacy? How is that your ambition in the world? And I tried to argue with him why that was a bad idea. And then I realized, well, we're probably all going to be pets for the robot overlords. If he wants to leverage the technology of the day, that's how most of the most successful people have always done it, you know, going back to the internet and railroad barons and oil and gas and I suppose all the way back to fire. So I tried to convince him instead that he wanted to be a good pet of the robot overlords and then figure out why that would work. Anyhow, so a couple years ago, Gartner came out with a statement that the smart machine era was the most disruptive in the history of IT. I actually consider that an understatement. I think it's the most disruptive in the history of technology and probably in the history of humans, and humans the most disruptive thing in the history of the planet, so that's a pretty big deal. What people don't really understand is that, you know, intelligent systems and smart robotic systems and smart automation, autonomy systems are really going to get a lot smarter, a lot faster. Talk about this in a second, but if you look at Moore's Law, 40 years from now, processors won't be, you know, 10 times better or 100 times better or 1,000 times better. They'll actually be about 100 million times better. And the implications of that are just absolutely profound. Your children will not drive. Your children will not write. They'll not compose music. They'll not make buying decisions, or at least they will not have to, because there's already software out there that are challenging human capabilities in all of these areas, and 100 million times faster than that in 40 years, better than that, it's going to be a completely different world. So I thought I'd put a couple slides up on what Moore's Law really looks like. I mean, it really is the design factor. Moore's Law says that processors double in capacity, actually density, but capacity every year and a half, roughly. And it actually has been that way for 30 years and doesn't really show any obvious signs of slowing down. So if you extend that out for 20 years, you know, that's about 10,000 times. You extend it out for 40 years, it's 100 million times. It's truly an exponential scale and very difficult to comprehend. But if you're designing an industrial system today, the rise of incredibly powerful computing capacity and also the rise of fast, easy networking, so connected computing, it's not just one of N factors in design. It is the factor. It's the most important thing you need to go look at. This change is going to rewrite vendor relationships, redefine profitability, change the way delivery works to end users, you know, change the environment, the costs of things, the products. And if you're a designer and you're trying to design something today, your challenge is to look beyond today's experience really into a future that is dominated by intelligent distributed computing. And that's what I call the robot overlords. So I want to take a quick look at, you know, what that implies. So what we see is implications on that. So, you know, in other words, why would you want to be a pet? So this is actually a picture of a modern operating theater. It's actually taken by one of our partners and customers, Dr. Goldman at Harvard Medical. And, you know, this is a typical operating theater. There's actually, he says, 42 devices in that picture. He has a version with them circled. I don't have that. But those devices today are completely disconnected, and all of the communications between the people and the devices and the patient is all talking or post-it notes or actually writing on patients. They actually will draw an X over your left kidney if that's what you're getting taken out, so they don't make mistakes around that. And fundamentally, there's no checking. And unfortunately, that leads to errors. The Institute of Medicine came out and said that hospital is the third leading cause of death in the United States after heart disease and cancer. That is a shocking statistic. How could that happen? Well, here's one example. This is one of the most common operations on the planet, heart bypass operation, and the anesthesiologist forgot to turn the ventilator back on. And after they took off the heart-lung bypass machine, and that's obviously a bad outcome. You say, well, you know, how often does that happen? Well, Harvard actually went around and surveyed all of the surgical teams in the area, not just in their hospitals, and unfortunately, every single surgical team had experienced the exact same error. They say, well, just fix that error. You got to add some process to make sure that happens or have somebody sit there. But the problem is they also identified hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of errors. It's just too complex of an environment to have people making all these checks all the time. So what do you do about it? Well, Dr. Goldman's idea, and actually now interesting thing, is connect them together. So you take the devices, and so this is a a simpler thing than an operation, the capnometer at the bottom, an oximeter, and an infusion pump, which is drug delivery, and you connect them together, and you're going to see this word data bus a lot. That's the technology that allows you to connect them together with the meaning of the data, or with the ability to really share data. And you connect them also with supervisory services, something that's smart enough to analyze the patient, figure out what's going on with the patient, and make some decisions about, you know, this patient's really in trouble, this patient, you know, maybe you need to turn off the morphine drip or something like that. The problem with the current alarms, almost every device in the hospital has alarms on it, but 80% of them are turned off because they can't check against each other. And, you know, so the alarm, this nuisance alarm, the whole conference is on nuisance alarms. But this system can be smart enough to check the action rate against the heart rate or something like that and make a decision that this really is a situation you should take care of. So that's, you know, that's the fundamental thing. The robot overlord here is the supervisory service that can make a better decision and be there 24/7 for the patient. A problem is not quite that simple because that's just one bed in a hospital. That's not what hospitals look like. They look more like this. There's lots of beds. That's not what they look like either. They look more like this. There's about 90 bed rooms in that picture. In fact, they look even more. This is a test we actually did for GE Healthcare as one of our customers doing this in our lab. This is a scalability test across the hospital. There's about 300 rooms. Each of those red dots, if think of it as a room. And their design criteria is 1,200 rooms and 200,000 devices in a hospital. And the real challenge here is now not just adding some simple smarts, so the smarts aren't simple, to a few machines. The real challenge is finding the right patient, having the right guaranteed delivery, dealing with the fact that 61% of patients move every day in the hospital, so you can't count on things like an IP address to find the patient, and you have to be able to get ambulatory. One of the most important things for heart operation, for instance, is to walk around the hospital. That means you're walking into wireless areas and maybe changing Wi-Fi access or something like that. It's a very complex IT environment, and it has to work every time. So, you know, GE is actually connecting together 300 types of devices and adding some intelligence to it to make this work and be a more successful environment. The fundamental thing is really different here. The medical industry, you know, a few years ago didn't do anything with networking. Those devices weren't connected together, and suddenly they're going to compete on networking. It's a huge change for their operations. Certainly not the only industry affected. This is a sort of a well-known problem with central generation. The way the power grid works today is there's big central generators that are spinning huge chunks of metal. Think of it, you know, spinning something that weighs 10 times what your car does, and lots of big windings on it. It spins at exactly 60 hertz in the U.S., and that frequency control that allows it to add energy when the load goes up is a technology invented, I think, in the 1930s. And the generators make the power. There's transmission lines that distribute to get the power to substations. I'm sure you've seen a substation in your neighborhood that steps it down and runs it off to all the houses and businesses. And it's all designed to be one way. And the problem is that's no longer truth. This is a famous thing in the power industry called the duck curve. It actually maps the expected penetration of solar energy in California. This is a typical spring day. At night there's very little solar energy. You don't have to be an electrical engineer to understand that. But during the day, as you get more and more solar energy, it becomes more and more percentage of what's going on. And the problem with that, there's many problems with that. One of them is you have to get all those generators running again. But a bigger problem is it takes about 15 minutes to change the amount of power a big generator is putting out, even a little bit. Here's the demand with no solar. Without solar, demand always changes a little bit. It has an average. It actually isn't much variation previously. You could pretty much guess what it was last Thursday. The weather's the same. It's likely to be that much this Thursday, and they have estimators running to figure that out. But the game is to always generate more power than load. If load ever crosses the power, you can lose frequency lock, and all sorts of very bad things happen. If you add solar distributed, first of all, there's no connection from the central office or from the generators to the houses today. And so they just see that as a drop in demand. But it's a very variable drop in demand. Every time a cloud goes over, clouds can cover entire neighborhoods in seconds. And every time that happens, the demand peaks. And because of that peaks, they're almost as high, not as high as the old one, but can be almost as high as the old system. You can only drop a little bit of generation. And the difference is actually called spinning reserves. Spinning reserves are almost as expensive as generating in the first place. And in fact, you have to have a lot of availability of spinning reserves, and that energy goes somewhere, can heat up the generators, and there's actually areas, I think San Diego's got the problem where they don't have enough spinning reserves in the oil-fired plants to cover their solar. They're actually considering building another oil-fired plant. But that's really not the best way to do it. That really seems crazy. The solution is just like the medical thing. You take a data bus. This is the industry actually calls it open field, a field message bus. Take the devices and here solar and battery and switches and things, and then put it on the bus with intelligence, with microgrid optimizer and policy manager, things like that. Then we'll go through the graph on the right that this shows what this system can do. The green here is the solar load and generation, and the yellow is from a battery, and you put those together and you get much slower dynamics that you can now follow with the generator. So you don't need 24 hours of storage. All you really need is about 15 minutes of storage, and you can balance out the load changes such that you can drop your spinning reserves a lot and make it much more efficient. So again, there's a huge problem here that the grid, which doesn't even have, there's no computer on the power pole outside your house. There's some pretty primitive ones in places like substations. But suddenly it has to implement distributed control, and there's a lot of efforts around building standards and things around to make that happen. And then another example everybody knows about, this is actually a picture taken across the bay from where I live in Sunnyvale. I need to get one on 101. There's plenty of traffic there. But, you know, it's a waste of time. It even gets worse than that. I started my career crashing cars for a living, doing biomechanic impact testing. Back then, I was all excited about maybe being able to make a dent in the 45,000 people a year being killed on United States freeways, highways. And I read just last year, this was 2016 now, 40,000 died. So, you know, we've gotten better, more miles being driven, so it's definitely a little better per mile. But fundamentally, you really can't do much about the fact that, you know, the number one safety problem causes 94% of all collisions is driver. So we've got to do something about that. Well, what do you do about that? Well, that's just why drive, you know. Autonomous cars. I call them carbots, by the way. People call them driverless cars. That will last as long as the horseless carriage is a name. It really is a new technology. It's going to change an amazing number of things in the economy, from, you know, obviously driving, but also roadside motels and insurance and you know, restaurants and DUI lawyers. Huge change in the way the world works very soon here. And it's not just cars, it's also mass transit. I'll talk about autonomous flight in a second. It really is a revolution. How do you do that? Well, it's the same kind of design. You take a data bus, take a data structure that allows you to share information very simply and aggressively and very, very completely, I suppose. It's very nice you can do this on a single structure. And you connect there all the sensors and the intelligent modules like data fusion, which are interpreting that perception system, and localization, and then situation awareness, which is very intelligent. You know, I'm coming into an intersection, I want to turn right, there's three cars coming that way, there's two cars over there, there's a pedestrian intersection, there's a cat in the intersection, there's a pothole in the intersection, trying to decide what you're going to be able to do. Planning is how you're actually going to do it. I'll wait for the pedestrian across, and then I'll miss the cat, and I'll go over the pothole, I don't care. Those kinds of decisions are actually the most intelligent part of what's going on, other than perception. And then you have to actually control the vehicle and, you know, talk to the car and all the devices in the car and maybe go up to the cloud and get some things like mapping and navigation and many other things, be able to navigate the car. All of these things sort of have to work together. It really is a huge software integration problem. And again, the biggest change of the industry is, you know, cars. If you actually go talk to software, to automobile executives, most of them have a background in one of two areas. They have a background in mechanical engineering or engine engineering, or they have a background in design style, because those have been the competitive basis for vehicles for decades. And suddenly, these cars are going to have to compete on software design. It's really a different world. So it's actually, you know, it's the most disruptive thing in the history of technology. What really is a disruption? I like to quote one of the local Valley VCs, software is eating the world. It really is a fundamental change in the way things happen, and especially distributed software is becoming competitively important in lots of industries. But I promise you, you know, what is industrial IoT anyway? And so I've got a pretty good view of that. And I'm actually now the vice chair of the IIC, which is the largest of the consortium out there, and you know, a lot of different kinds of applications. And I thought I'd start with the big picture. And if that's not the big picture, I don't know what is. Actually, the biggest picture isn't the galaxy that's dominating this picture. It's all the other little dots, which are thousands and thousands of other galaxies. In any direction you look in the sky, you'll see about the same density. So, you know, there's hundreds of billions of galaxies out there. And my point here is that the universe is really large. It's truly amazing how big it is. And, you know, this is actually the IIC's, what they call a vertical taxonomy. These are the industries that are going to be affected by the industrial internet. And, you know, people always say, well, you know, the internet changed everything. But if you actually really look at what did the internet really change, it changed banking, it changed media, it changed retail, it changed travel agencies, it's in the process of changing taxis. It created some things like search and social media. But if you walk into a power plant, or you walk into a hospital, or you walk into a factory, or any of these other areas, it didn't affect them at all. The industrial Internet of Things is going to affect all of those as their things get smart. So it's going to have, you know, all the analysts claim multi-trillion-dollar impact. I think the lowest number I've seen is about $2 trillion, and the highest number I've seen is $100 trillion. But still, there's many, many use cases in many different areas across the industry. And I just want to give you one example of something that didn't change. This is an ultrasound imaging system. It fundamentally didn't change how these work. It looks newer today, or, you know, but it still has a screen and a keyboard, and it's on wheels, and you wheel it into the room, and you do your scan of the patient, and then you get physical media. Back then, you got a Polaroid picture. Now you might get a DVD, but that's the way it's still working out there. And we have an interesting customer that's trying to change that. BK Medical. And I'll talk about how they're doing that with one of my favorite TV shows, Star Trek. And if you're actually online and you know the name of that character, I'll give you an extra kudos at the end for being a power nerd. But the way this works in Star Trek is you have your little device, you have your visualization thing. That little device gets the raw data, sends it to some intelligence, which may be a cloud, likely on the starship, so it's private cloud, and then that shows up on the device. And that allows you to, you know, now it's online, so you can go to the public cloud and get it wherever you want. And coolest thing is every doctor can have their own device, and each of those devices can be, you know, a handheld thing carried around. Today, its data rate's a little too high to not have it wired, but that won't last long. And you could have 1,000 doctors have 1,000 devices. Maybe none are doing imaging. Maybe all 1,000 of them are doing imaging. If you have scalable, elastic computing available, you can handle the imaging load, whatever it happens to be. It completely changes the business model and the use. You don't have to go buy machines and look for them and walk around the hospital trying to find them and things like that. It's a completely different environment, completely transformative business issue. So that's the kind of thing we see coming. I get a lot of questions like, you know, what's the cloud? What's the fog? So I put together my easy definitions. So you'll hear, you know, cloud is a multi-tenanted elastic computing environment with blah, blah, blah. If you actually go look at the IIC's vocabulary document, I have a very crisp definition of what a cloud is. But I think for the purpose of this, a cloud is a big building full of lots of computers. The average cost of a data center is about $7 billion. So, you know, think of it as just a lot of computers running somewhere. It doesn't matter where or how many of them there are. That's what the cloud is. IT is software that runs in the cloud mostly, and the people who manage it. I'll define a thing as any physical device with computing. So your smart thermostat is a thing. Your phone is a thing. Your car is a thing. Soon everything will be man-made. Everything man-made will be a thing. We actually had a debate at RTI a while back. You know, 50 years from now, name something that won't have a processor in it. Because processors will basically be free. And you know, come up with some kind of thing in the world that's man-made that couldn't be better if it was smart. And we actually failed. I mean, desks and pens and light bulbs are already doing this, and you know, roads and concrete. You can already buy chips that you put in concrete, and as it's curing, their little RFID tags, it has enough intelligence that you can tell if it's sufficiently cured by scanning it to know if you can build the next layer of your building. I mean, all of these things, everything's going to be smart. It's really a truly amazing opportunity. Anyhow, things are not in a data center. Everything outside of a data center. And operational technology is the computing and the people, engineers mostly, that build those things. The edge is not my favorite term. So I have this picture from the New Yorker, this famous picture that from New Yorkers' point of view, most of the world is in New York. Well, from the IT's point of view, most of the world is in the cloud. And the entire rest of the real world is called the edge. Fog is really intelligent stuff on the edge. Sort of an argument whether the edge includes the fog or the fog includes the edge. It doesn't really matter. It's intelligent, cloud-like stuff, not in a data center. IoT is confusing to a lot of people because IoT is really all of the above, everything above. You know, as long as it has something in it that's not in a data center, is IoT. And industrial IoT, I will define as anything that doesn't show up in your local store, with the possible exception of autonomous drive cars, or is it clear, non-obvious that autonomous drive cars are going to end up in your local, you're going to buy one, you may just use them. So that's really an easy working definition of all this stuff. I do want to point out the IoT and the industrial IoT are quite different. Consumer IoT you'll hear all about with thermostats and Fitbits and garage doors that know when you open them and things like that are a very different thing. We're talking about the industrial IoT. Consumer IoT is about 80% of the hype out there. The World Economic Forum actually predicted that the industrial IoT will be 80% of the value, not nearly as fast. But it really is a very disruptive environment, and most disruptive thing is architecture that can sort of connect some sort of cloud and between vendors and across industries. And that's really what the IIC is targeting developing or designing anyway. I do think we've got a lot of experience here, and there's three, I call them spheres, three really different classes of applications. So even in the industrial IoT, by the way, this, you'll hear about IoT platforms. I think there's somewhere between 400 and 500 IoT platforms, and most of them do something different than the other ones. But even, you know, IoT applications, IoT platforms, they tend to fall into three different categories of stuff. And the first one we call device monitoring. The entire consumer IoT lives here. Device monitoring from a connectivity point of view, which is, of course, our view. You have a single device, it talks to a single service in the cloud, And it's smart about that device. So in the consumer space, that's thermostats and Fitbits. In the industrial space, it's things like predictive maintenance or tracking, those kind of things where you're just trying to know where one device, what one device is doing, or when it's going to fail, or where it is. Analytic optimization is a little more sophisticated than that, from a connectivity point of view at least, where you take a plant and you put, you know, 1,000 sensors all over the plant, and you collect all that data up to the cloud. It's mostly one-way data flow, and in the cloud you're going to run analytics and big data analysis and figure out what's going on with that plant so you can optimize it. Both of those are really targeting decreasing OPEX, operational expenses, in current systems, and so there's a lot of the attention on those. But actually, the bigger thing long-term, we call edge autonomy, where you actually take the intelligence and you put it in the field. Both of these are really intelligence, is up in the cloud, and you put it in the field. I use an autonomous car here as a sort of poster example, where now the action's really in the field. The cloud may be involved. I'm saying the cloud's not involved. It may be very involved, but it's not the main show. The main show is connecting things out in the industry. And to give you some really quick examples, I just pulled these off the IIC's website. So this is actually something that was called track and trace. It's an ability to track around devices and things in the environment so you can do a better job with assembly and make sure that the correct bolts are tightened. This application is, device monitoring application. This application is, you know, where are my containers? What's in them? Device monitoring application. This one is trying to increase safe work classes and employee safety in a big plant. So now you're tracking the people around. There's actually a test bed. This is that test bed thing at IIC that's putting intelligence into helmets. So when you wear your hard hat and walk around, you can tell where you are, and even tell if you've walked into a room with noxious gas or if you've fallen, things like that. Safety monitoring. Those are all sort of device monitoring. Here's a sort of more typical analytic optimization where you've got a big factory and you want to take all of the information in the factory and get it up to the cloud so you can analyze it up there, save lots of money annually, improve yields, that kind of stuff. And then this is actually the one I just went over with DK Medical, where you're trying to actually change the way something works with intelligence in the field. That's an edge autonomy application. So, you know, what are these things going to do? This is my humble opinion of the market evolution. At the moment, they are pretty much separate applications, where device monitoring is, you know, certainly growing aggressively, analytic optimization is growing, edge autonomy is, you know, the most advanced computationally and the smallest market today. Arrows are a little bit backwards in size there. I think, you know, what people don't realize is these are confusing now because we're here. This is where you are in this diagram. And this diagram is not, you know, 100 years out. This is just 10 years out or so. And in fact, if you want to look out a little farther than that, I shrunk the diagram down. So there's where we were before. And as you look in the future, they actually merge. We expect them to merge. So it's not really the evolution of a use case. It's a progress of categories of use cases. As they get more and more intelligent, processors get cheaper in the field, and better connectivity between the edge and the cloud, you can build very intelligent systems across all of those. So that's really the industrial IoT long-term evolution. And again, I don't think this is more than 30 or 40 years out. Definitely not the same across all industries as far as adoption rate, but it's really going to change everything. I thought I'd give you a quick overview of where RTI fits into that, just so you know where I'm coming from here. We're the largest connectivity framework vendor and actually the largest embedded middleware of any kind of middleware, analysts say. We've got about 1,000 designs out there, and we sell product based on something called BDS, which is a standard. I'll talk about that in a later instance of this. But We also are, these are actually all applications. I'm going to talk about some of them later. We're also very active in consortia, mostly because we're trying to help people do designs around using this technology we call data centricity, or is data centricity, across, you know, ship systems and avionics and cars and process control and robotics and power systems and medical and, you know, real-time Ethernet. And all these things are all these industries are trying to find a way forward. Our particular little niche in that, we are not an AI company and we're not a networking company. We're a software company that connects them together. So we like to say that we live at the intersection of functional artificial intelligence, which I can define if you like. It just means smart. It may or may not be, you know, deep learning and that kind of stuff. It's definitely an intelligent kind of system. And the pervasive networking that we see building, we're out there trying to make them connect together. I do want to really quickly talk about the IIC. The IIC is the largest of the IoT consortia out there, industrial IoT for sure. And it's really trying to build an industrial Internet of Things architecture that, you know, can really transform both business and society and how these things work. It's actually a pretty big organization. There's 260 members plus. There's 30-plus countries. It is, I credit it with creating the industrial Internet of Things market before the IIC was formed in 2014. So industrial Internet of Things has really only existed, in my humble opinion, since that, 2014. So not even, it's about 4 years now. And yeah, I give it credit for starting the market because the Stanford Business School definition of a market is a group of consumers with similar needs who communicate. And the consumers have been out there, the needs have been out there, but this is the first place where you can walk in and talk to a medical device manufacturer, an oil and gas organization, and manufacturing systems, and you know, power and oil, you know, just all the industries are there, and you know, it's the only place I know of that you can easily get together and really do designs across all these industries. You know, the IIC's main sort of goals in the world is really three things they do. An ecosystem, which is trying to create the markets and help people partner and get together. We're building a architecture, guidance. It's not a standards organization, but it is helping people choose standards and use standards. And then the testbed program, which is out there, you know, trying to make sure things actually work. The guidance is, the IIC is really good at pumping out lots of guidance. It's really interesting stuff. I'll talk about some of it later, but there's, you know, high-level architecture, very detailed connectivity, but things like security and analytics and edge computing and all of these things, data management that are critical in these systems are well in play and being developed. The ones that are circled there are released already. And then the other big thing going on at the IIC is test beds. Until I was elected vice chair, I was the chair of the test bed subcommittee. Test beds are an amazing variety in so many different areas. It's the most comprehensive by far. And what I find most inspiring is the variety of things out there. So it's got stuff like microgrids, trying to figure out how power systems work, and healthcare, and manufacturing, many in manufacturing areas, some things, you know, airline baggage management, digital, industrial digital threads. I mean, just so many different areas that we're trying to, you know, do the test beds, help us figure out our guidance, help us figure out how we can build an architecture that goes across all of them. You know, again, our RTIs are all really quick. This fits our vision well, so we're sort of all over this. We participate or lead an amazing variety of things there. So if you have any kind of questions about the IIC, let me know, and I'll connect you with the right place. But I just, you know, wanted to quickly go through and give you some real examples that we're involved with, how this how the IoT is going to transform across different industries. And you know, what I'm really trying to get here is the variety of things that are impacted by connected computing. So this is the first one I'll start with, Audi. This is actually not in the car. That red thing at the top is a car. This thing at the bottom that looks sort of like a lab is also a car. It may not look like a car, but it's called a hardware-in-loop simulator. They took all of the electronic components, everything connected to a wire in that vehicle, or connected to electricity, I suppose, and put it on a wall. So all these called ECUs, the little computers in the cars, 300 to 500 of them in a typical car, the instrument panel, the seat warmers, the blinkers, the, you know, controllers for the transmission, anti-lock brakes, everything, put it up on the wall and run a software simulation that makes it think that it's driving as a car, and that software simulation, and now you can test all your ECUs and all your software. And the simulator runs, you know, 20-minute or so scenario of the car, you know, backs out of the garage and floors the gas or whatever and slides and whatever the scenario is, you want it to test all these things. The problem is during those tests, a lot of the ECUs will fail, and you need some way to fail over the software backup so you can continue to test. And also the simulators that are out there are not, you can't buy the best simulators all from the same company, so connecting them together is sort of a challenge. But I don't have time to go through all of these, but, you know, complex traffic control. This is actually Shanghai Airport. BDS standards been used at Shanghai Airport for ground control for a few years now, and now it's almost all the airports in Southeast China, and expand air operations. We're already running air operations in several places. This is Canada, helping NAV Canada build the connectivity between their control stations and within the control stations. Other transportation, GE Transportation, builds locomotives, you know, big train systems and trackside information systems. Autonomous cars are a really hot market these days. We're actually in, the number's a little wrong now, but you know, more than 14 of them production track, where they're actually taking them the final proof of concept and figuring how to actually go build it. We joined this organization called AutoSAR, which is a pretty exciting development because AutoSAR is probably the best known standard out there in this area. Oh, by the way, something wrong with that picture. I don't like pictures of autonomous cars with rear-view mirrors, so I photoshopped it out. you know, but the other kind of transportation, too, Hyperloop. If you don't know what Hyperloop is, it's going to change the world more than any other transportation in 20 years, I will predict. It really, you know, can move you from city to city in 10 or 20 minutes. It would take you hours to drive and doesn't have traffic problems and very, very high throughput. But also, there's modernizing the transit control in metro transit. We've actually been running, working with NASA forever. NASA's our first customer. There's a launch control system for Orion. They claim it's the world's the largest SCADA system on the planet. It's just as a single system, that's probably true. And, you know, we run all those devices, all the launch control, but also flight monitoring and reentry tracking and recovery. Those systems are all running that. We have a really interesting customer, Airbus, building a flying car. They call it Zahana. They're actually running flight tests. They ran their first public flight test a couple months ago. It's online. But they're building out a all-electric, fully safety certified, autonomous single passenger vehicle that can, you know, I think its range is like 40 miles or something like that, you know, take you to the airport or wherever. It's really a pretty exciting new technology. Many different kinds of A&D programs, sort of where DDS first took off as in the Navy and any other kinds of defense programs. The Navy sort of standardized it across their surface ship programs and all the combat management. We're also in commercial shipping and even fish farming. One of the problems with fish salmon farming is they've got environmental problems. A lot of those are caused by something called sea lice. This customer's actually built laser systems to shoot sea lice. Pretty interesting application. Big science telescopes. My background sort of in astronomy when I was a kid. This is actually called the Extremely Large Telescope. What's exciting about it is that's Hubble on the left there. This is something called the VLT. It's our current technology, very large telescope. And the ELT is going to have that much better resolution. And it does that by having very high speed control of a lot of mirrors so it can cancel out atmospheric problems. Big power plants with Grand Coulee is the largest power plant in North America. It's also the fastest power plant in North America. And as I started out talking about power at the beginning, a lot of the problem in power isn't the number of megawatts or gigawatts you can generate, but how you adjust those quickly to match the generation to the load. So Grand Coulee is not only the largest, it's also the fastest. It can take almost 7 gigawatts on and off the grid in about 10 minutes, which there's nothing else out there that can do that. And they're actually deploying that across the whole hydropower, at least the Army Corps of Engineers hydropower portfolio now. Wind power is a big deal. Siemens has got thousands of wind generators out there. Archie is sort of into this the green energy renewable space and hydro and wind and solar. We do also drilling automation, huge new trend in the oil and gas industry where they're trying to be less expensive but also make less mistakes. That's one of the big companies, a small, very well-funded startup building a completely robotic drilling system. Medical imaging systems are very complex machines. This is GE's Revolution CT. It's just an amazing device if you ever get a chance to see one or use one. It's able to take static shots of a beating heart and things like that. GE, I already talked about. Medical robotics, a very hot market, all in stealth mode. There's some really difficult things to do, like do force control. This particular system required a 3 kilohertz loop to do that. This is one of my favorite technologies. It's really a Star Trek technology. You can take a retinal blastoma out of your eye without damaging your vision. It does that by firing protons instead of X-rays at the tumor. They have to be very accurately controlled. And the hard part, those protons have to be fired at about 70% the speed of light. So it needs a full superconducting synchrocyclotron particle accelerator that can fire those things right. This is what it looks like. There's a person down there in the bottom left to give you an idea of the scale. And this is actually the smallest of the PBRT systems out there. Most of them, a lot of them take up whole city blocks. And then finally, this is a company building emergency medical response equipment, things you can carry into a fire. They're making a big difference in the survivability rates of heart attack victims. And so I just wanted to give you an idea of this, the breadth across all these different industries. It really is an inspiring world out there of different things. And I'm excited to be part of that, and I'm hoping that through this series I can bring some of that to the people out, everybody out there, so you can get a feel for what's going on. So this is the first of the series, The Rise of the Robot Overlord. What is the IoT anyway? I have a rough plan for the rest of them. I'm going to give you a quick teaser for where they are and why I think these might be valuable to people out there. So this is part one. Part two, I'd like to go and analyze some work that the IIC did over several years. They built a thing called the Industrial Net Connectivity Framework. Actually has three major parts in it. It has a architecture for putting, well, first of all, it has a assessment template. So what actually is important in a connectivity technology? And then it took a bunch of, so that's actually a pretty significant piece of work. It took the six most common connectivity technologies that we see out there. The standards you see here, DDS, OPC, UA, 1M2M, RESTful, HTTP, MQTT, and CoAP, and ran that through an assessment, and then importantly sort of built a new stack model and an architecture that can put those things together. It's pretty exciting in my humble opinion. My goal here with it is to help people start off in the right direction. We've put together a set of simple diagnostic questions you can ask if you're starting a new direction to figure out which of these technologies you should use. And then, you know, the surprising thing is they don't overlap much. If you think you can choose MQTT or OPC UA or DDS for your application, I hate to tell you, you're probably wrong. They really don't compete much, and you should understand what your application is doing before and which ones really fit before you choose that. You know, in the future, we're going to need connectivity that goes beyond that, and so there's this thing called the core connectivity architecture, or core connectivity standard architecture, and that allows you to take some connectivity architectures that are quite general, and we're actually defining those standards and building standard core gateways. Actually, OMG's voting on a DDS and OPC UA standard core gateway this week. So it's you know, not done yet, but it's getting very close to done. There's already things for connecting web services to these various technologies. And then you can build a true cross-industry, large Internet of Things architecture by connecting those core standards together. Second, I'd like to look at some of the theory. And in particular, I think the most important part of the theory, which isn't really well understood out there, is integration theory, how you actually put together the final system. And I'm going to use as examples for that DDS, which is data-centric, very much software integration, and OPC UA, which is very much aimed at device-centric integration, and how they're so different and how maybe you could put them together. I won't talk about it too much here, but the integration approaches are quite different, and it actually does make a lot of sense to integrate them together if you have both challenges. And this gateway is a thing that's now being standardized. So that's a pretty exciting development. We'll talk about that. And Databus is sort of a new kid on the block. It is a very different technology. It's data-centric. My best way to explain why it's a new kid on the block is it's database is to a file system, and a Databus is to a messaging system. That's really a completely different way of looking at how you do connectivity between applications. And we'll go through its most puzzling, I suppose, mindset-changing thing, which is the data-everywhere abstraction. It actually makes it look like the data is everywhere, even in a system with 300,000 devices. The data is virtually everywhere. That's a very different abstraction than things like service-oriented architectures or object-oriented architectures, or MoMA systems, message-oriented middleware. It's, you know, I'll claim it's magic, definitely parallel. And then maybe we'll go through to some examples. This is Grand Coulee and big power plant, how you do what's now called the ISC calls the layered data bus architecture. Allows you to scale to very large systems. And then your security is a huge problem. I'm not going to talk about it here, but there's many layers. You sort of have security, defense, and depth, and we'll focus mostly on connectivity security. It's a really the most important thing in a distributed system is to lock down all the pieces and understand all the way from hardware root trust to a large distributed data transactions kind of system. And then finally, I'd like to sort of end with a deeper example on autonomous vehicles. It's near and dear to my heart, something that RTI is very deeply involved with. The challenge there is really just an amazing ton of data. This is a data flow estimate for sort of research class today autonomous vehicle. And if you actually add this all up, it comes out to about 100 terabytes a day. I've actually heard people claim they're going to stream that all to the cloud so they can use that. I don't think that's at all a reasonable thing to do. But really the challenge here is how do you deal with massive data flow and very specific data flow. And when you get to where you can deal with that, then you can take a look at how that can change your design inside the vehicle. So today's vehicles, the autonomous vehicles, are mostly sending everything with a big central processor. But that has some problems like wiring and redundancy. But if you can actually do some of the intelligence out near the sensors, or it's a very simple example, you can be much more efficient. And because of that, as we walk up the autonomy scale, so this is the sort of famous five-level scale of autonomy, how do you actually make this work? We can look at the main technologies out there that are used at these different levels and how they interplay with each other and how they help you build complex systems. And we have some great examples to talk about there. And so really finally I want to end with maybe a more philosophical and forward-looking, what is the age of the robot overlords really going to be about? I do think it's hugely disruptive. I love this quote by John Chambers, who is the legendary CEO of Cisco. You don't compete against competitors, you compete against market transitions. I started out this talk without saying how these huge transitions in the way different industries have to interact and compete are now on software and things like that. It really is the mother of all transitions, and at least so far. And the real value is to try to build an architecture work that. So your kids may not drive or write or compose music, but they will. They'll live in a cleaner world and a safer, healthier world and in a safer, better transportation world than they do today. And I think that is a great outcome. So the economists are all claiming it's going to be a huge thing. Everybody's afraid, what are people going to do? What's going to happen to all the jobs? I think that is short-sighted. It's very difficult to know what happened to all the jobs. In fact, even if you knew today, you probably couldn't explain it. You couldn't go back 40 years ago and explain to somebody who didn't know what a network or a computer was even, what the maintenance people do for the back-end cloud servers at Facebook. I mean, they wouldn't even know what social media is or what the cloud is or data centers or computers. I mean, the world's changing faster every day, but the numbers out there are huge. And what that really means is there is an absolute amazing amount of opportunity. So I started off with a story about my 14-year-old. This is actually a picture of him when he was five. I just want to make it clear that the industrial is a trillion-dollar feast. There's more flavors of ice cream out there than ever before. There's plenty for everybody. The problem is it's melting. You're really facing a cultural shift, not just a technology shift, but a cultural shift in companies. Companies have to adapt software. They have to embrace the pace of change, which is really hard. And the decisions that you're making today that are going to last for years or even decades are going to determine, what you can do in the future in many, many ways. The risks are unprecedented. The opportunities are unprecedented. The robot overlords are already here. And if you want to know my humble opinion how you can thrive in the age of the robot overlords, I think you need to embrace the robot overlords. Like my son, it's not so bad to be a pet. It's going to be a good pet, and if you can do that, you're all set. And I need a little rhyming thing. Find your link to things that think. If you're looking for a job, my kids ask me all the time, what should they do for jobs in the future? I said, the one thing you should do is really what you shouldn't do. You shouldn't expect to learn something when you're in your teens or 20s and do that for the rest of your life. And when you see the world changing, be one of the first to move, not one of the last to move. If you're agile and you move around, it'll be a long, long time before these robot overlords take all human jobs. I think in the short term, there's going to be a lot more jobs out there than there were in the past. There is an ebook coming out. It's actually, you can register for it online. It's in the final formatting right now. It's a users group meeting. This is the one just this quarter, next few months. I have one in Silicon Valley in the fall as well. And I will end with my contact slide. Please contact me. Easiest way is on LinkedIn or email. That would be great.
Great, thanks. That's a lot of robots rising. A fantastic overview and really leads great into the coming sections. I want to thank Stan for sharing your insights on the industrial IoT. We at Open Systems Media and RTI want to thank you, the audience, for participating today. We didn't get to any questions, but keep in mind, we hope you join us for the subsequent series, and there'll be more time for questions. This eCast will be posted online at the URL shown on your screen in 24 hours. An audio-only podcast version will also be made available there. You can do a web search with the keywords embedded space dash eCast and find all of Open Systems Media eCast available for download there as MP3s. Open Systems Media eCast are copyrighted and may not be recorded or used in any way without the express written consent of Open Systems Media. Thanks for attending and have a great day.